Thanks for joining us, everyone. Today I have Jim Gottstein with me today. I came across him through, who was it? Probably Robert Whittaker. I recently read Anatomy of an Epidemic and Man in America. And in Anatomy of an Epidemic, Robert Whittaker mentioned Jim Gottstein, and he said that he was perhaps one of the individuals doing the most for I wish I had the quote. He said that Jim Gottstein was one of the individuals that was doing the most for victims of psychiatric treatment. And so I looked up Jim Gottstein, and I found his book, The Zyprexa Papers. And I recently finished reading that. It is a great and terrifying read. I recommend it to all of you. And I have him on with us today. He is a retired lawyer from Alaska, and he's going to be talking with us a little bit about the Zyprexa papers, his work, and Psych Rights, which is a nonprofit organization that I believe he founded. So, Jim Gottstein, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've done quite a few of these interviews, and I don't know how many of my listeners are familiar with your story, but could you start with just kind of a brief rundown of what it was that got you, an Alaskan lawyer, interested in defending the rights of psychiatric survivors and patients?
So when I was in 1982, when I was 29, I'd got myself in a situation where I was trying to do too much. I'd gone to Israel and Europe and came back and was running for the legislature and opening my law practice. And I didn't sleep. And so I subsequently found out that anybody who doesn't sleep will, you know, I like the word crazy, you know, the clinical word is psychotic, will go psychotic. And so that happened to me, and I went over to my dad's house to try and get some sleep, and I fallen asleep for just, I think, a second, and I've had this happen to me since. And I woke up, and the devil was coming down the hall after me. And so I was on the second floor, and I looked out the window, and there's this lawn down there and a sidewalk. And I knew how to do a parachute landing fall. And so I figured, and I was in my underwear, by the way, and it was 1 a.m. in the middle of June. So I jumped out the window and did a perfectly good parachute landing fall, didn't hurt myself a bit, ran across the street into this parking lot, this school parking lot, and I was looking over my shoulder for the devil. So I was spinning around, and so that was logical, right? You know, running away from the devil. Anyway, so they came in a paddy wagon, put me in a straitjacket, and shot me up with something to sleep. And I woke up, and there was a male nurse or something at the foot of the bed with a clipboard, and he asked, "What day is it?" And I asked, "How long have I been asleep?" And so he puts down that I didn't know what day it was. And that's kind of how things went. More to your question. So those that believed I was a lawyer said I would never do that again. And when I had told them I had gone to Harvard Law School, that confirmed I was delusional. And they told me that like I said, I would never practice law again, that the best I could hope for was to take these debilitating drugs for the rest of my life and minimize my time in the loony bin. And I was really lucky. My mother was actually the executive director of the Alaska Mental Health Association, and she knew this marvelous psychiatrist by the name of Robert Alberts, Bob Alberts, had been a Japanese prisoner of war during World War II. Anyway, he told me you just got in a situation where you didn't sleep, and you just need to, learn how to deal with that. And I did. And so I was lucky to have escaped being made permanently mentally ill by the system. And it changed the trajectory of my life, and to, be an advocate slash attorney for people in the system to try and help people not being made into, permanent mental patients.
So you saw, even though you didn't, you weren't, like a permanent mental patient or a mental patient for even 5 or 10 years, but you saw how easily you could have become one. And did you personally know any other people who were kind of in the system at that time?
Not that I recall, no.
Yeah. That was enough to really, what, build your empathy, or really, it was like a call to action for you?
Right. And basically, I said it changed the trajectory of my life, but it really kind of gave me a different purpose in life. So this, basically became my main purpose in life. And so rather than, I was my dad had was a partner and what a few years later became the largest private, Alaska owned business. And I was set to go in the business, and in fact I did for a while. And and I basically from that I had a share in the business, and I had enough income of that. Changed it at one point, but that I had enough income to live on. And to me, devoting my life to making more money than I needed wasn't something, it wasn't really how I wanted to spend my time. So it really gave me the freedom to do this. And I had been actually working on this case that my mother had gotten me into, where the state of Alaska had stolen 1 million acres of land that had been given in trust by the federal government for the necessary expenses of the mental health program of Alaska. And so that was a big case. And I actually had my episode right as I was starting to draft that complaint. And I ended up getting in that case later. Again, later. Anyway, it was just like a very significant event in my life, maybe the most significant.
Curious, have you ever thought of, you could have seen all kinds of things. You could have seen a lion, or you could have seen, I don't know. Why do you think you saw the devil? Have you ever thought of that?
Well, it's a good question. I never actually saw the devil. I just heard him coming down the
The
hall.
feeling.
So, no, and it's interesting. I'm not at all religious. So, I mean, I think it's just something deep in my psyche. It's, maybe it's deep in everybody or most people's psyche. I don't know. I think it just, is the personification of evil. So it might just, so I have this evil after me.
Yeah. And it's interesting just thinking of the symbolism and running from that. And ultimately, that's what led you to doing all of this great work that you've done. I forget the psychiatrist's name. What was his name that you mentioned? The one that helped you out of it?
Robert Alberts. So I could say a couple other things. Okay, like, I mean, there are all these things that happened in the hospital. One is they wanted to put me on lithium, and they did. And I was a pilot, and I told, which was really important to me. And I said, I lose my medical certificate if I'm on lithium, so I don't want me. They couldn't care less. And so that was not even a factor. And so they, but they had to, they did this creatinine clearance test, which tests your kidneys, I guess. It came up abnormal. So they needed to do a kidney biopsy, and they sent me to this nephrologist, the kidney doctor. And he was poking me with this giant needle to get a, sample of my kidney, and he couldn't find my kidney. And so I never got put on lithium as a result of that. So that, I consider myself the luckiest guy on the planet. And so, and that was an example. And I had trouble, I lost my medical certificate for, I forget how long, maybe a year or so, maybe not even. But Dr. Alberts really went to bat for me and helped me get it back.
Oh, good. In your opinion, a psychiatrist like Dr. Alberts, who can listen to your story and is like, yeah, you didn't sleep for a long time. That's going to happen to anybody with enough of a lack of sleep. We just need to get you able to figure out how to fix that before it becomes a problem, or like, yeah, preventative maintenance, basically. In your opinion, how many psychiatrists these days work in that manner?
So one of the things he was popular, and he wanted to get a partner, and he said that it was so hard to find any psychiatrist with any common sense. And I don't know how many total, I don't know, but it's probably around 1%. I mean, it's quite rare. So anyway, I mean, basically the mental health system is insane if the purpose is to actually help people.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about, I'm studying clinical psychology and I'm on my internship now. And coming up through, I never even questioned medications. That was the Department of Psychiatry. If I was working with someone, let's say severely depressed and therapy wasn't seeming to help, maybe refer them over to get psychiatric medications or check to see if it's a medical issue or, and then I had no trouble doing that. That's just kind of what you do. You do therapy or you do psychological testing. The psychiatrist does medication. All of it's helpful. It was never even talked about. But it seems that there's a different story. And so the Zyprexa papers, can you tell us a little bit about what that book is about? And well, even before the Zyprexa papers, before you got that information, were you made aware of the negatives or the potential, all of the negative side effects of psychiatric medication?
So, I kind of had an idea about them. I mean, when I was in the hospital, I'd heard about Thorazine, and I told them, I don't want Thorazine. And they said, oh, we'll give you Melaril. It's nothing like Thorazine. Well, it's exactly like Thorazine. But anyway, but I had an idea about the drugs, and didn't feel like I had anything particular, to contribute to the effort. I had someone who kept saying, oh, you should, get involved with these people nationally and all that. And it was like, I did advocacy in Alaska. I was on the mental health board. But then I read Mad in America by Bob Whitaker, which is, what turned you on to this too. He later wrote Anatomy of an Epidemic. And to me, I mean, it's a great read. But to me, it was also a litigation roadmap for how to challenge forced drugging, not just on, the civil rights aspect of it, but that it is harmful and counterproductive. And in other words, it's not in people's best interest. And Well, I guess that's a value call. Well, that I say it that way because that's the legal standard. One of the legal standards for forcing someone to take drugs is it's got to be in their best interest. And so I contacted, well, actually, there's this organization called NARPA, the National Association of Rights Protection and Advocacy, and they did this annual conference. And it was going to be in, well, it was in November in Portland that year. And Bob Whitaker was going to be there and give a keynote. And Lauren Mosher, who had done the Soteria study in the 70s, which we might talk about, but in any event, which proved that you could do better by not doing the drugs. And Michael Perlin, who is has been described as the icon of mental health law. He's a professor of law at New York Law School at the time. And so I basically crashed that conference. And by that, I mean, okay, I could register, but it was way too late to sign up to do a presentation or anything. So I rented a meeting room, right, just on my own. And I went with, I don't know, probably 2 dozen copies of Mad in America. And I printed up flyers and said, here, I'm going to, what was it? Something that this talk called unwarranted psychiatric forced psychiatric drugging, a call to action. I had flyers and I offered to give away copies of Mad in America. And it turns out there's this other organization there, Mind Freedom, and they were selling copies of Mad in America. But it actually worked out really well because the people who could afford to buy it bought it, and the people who really couldn't afford to buy it got free copies from me. And I met Bob. He came to my talk, and I met Michael Perlin and Lauren Mosher, who ended up testifying in my first Alaska, well, the case that became my first Alaska Supreme Court win. That's how I got into the kind of into the advocacy, and I formed the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, Psych Rights, whose mission is to mount a strategic litigation campaign against forced psychiatric drugging and electroshock, and started a website, psychrights.org, and one of the first things I did was I got Bob Whitaker, Robert Whitaker, to send me all the research that he cited in that in America. And I scanned it and posted it on the website. And that was the start of a lot of research. It's called Scientific Research by Topic on the website. And so then we were off and running and I started doing litigation.
Okay. Okay. I looked at the Psych Rights website right before we got on here, and it looks like currently maybe it says Psych Rights strategic litigation is currently inactive pending funding.
Yeah, well, and actually I've gotten old and I'm in Maui now. And so, I need help. I mean, I write about it in my book about, there's also a 9-minute video on YouTube, Escape from Psychiatry, Jim Gottstein's story, where I go through all this stuff. And the litigation, I mean, the trick for me is, to get sleep. And the problem is, it almost always was, if I had something, a big project or a deadline, and I wasn't on top of it, I couldn't. My mind was going, I was thinking about it and I couldn't sleep. One of my adjustments was to try and always file things the day before they were due. which is pretty unusual for a lawyer because you can always make things better. But I, to me, it was more important to get things in. And I, and what my approach was, well, I want it to be good enough. And I feel like my good enough is pretty good. And I file it the day before. And that way I wouldn't get into such a sleep problem. But litigation is really intense, and you have deadlines. And like if you're actually in trial, a multi-day trial, you know, you end one day and you got to figure out what happened and then what you're going to do the next day. So it's really tough. And but most litigation is a pretty slow moving affair. But these involuntary or psychiatric imprisonment cases, I think involuntary commitment is kind of a euphemism. And forced drugging cases, they happen fast. So like in Alaska, Anchorage in particular, they might have, at the time, five or so cases every Tuesday and Friday. And they would mostly file them that morning and give them to the public defender that morning, and they'd have all five cases that day. I mean, it's just a farce in terms of the legal proceeding. And I, you know, if I took a case, I'd tell my potential client, you know, I'm not going to do it today. I can't, you know, prepare anything today. If you want to go today, then you know, go with your public defender and public pretender. And you know, you almost certainly lose. And if you go with me, you have a fair chance of winning. But you can't stretch them out too long. In Alaska, you could only postpone it for up to 7 days. And they really want to get the hospital really wants to get the people drugged right away, and so they're pushing for that. And they would have the two at the same time. They'd have the commitment, and then they'd have the forced drugging. And I, you know, like I kind of refused to do that. I really tried to separate the forced drugging from the psychiatric imprisonment case. And I won an Alaska Supreme Court case on that, because the statute says first you have to be committed, and then you do the forced drugging. And there's the idea is that the psychiatric imprisonment cases have to be done very quickly because the person's locked up. And there needs to be a judicial, you know, determination whether or not the state hospital is entitled to lock the person up. So there's some, you know, reason to do that very quickly. Forced drugging, not so much. Although the, you know, the doctors say, oh, you know, the brain will deteriorate if you don't, you know, give these drugs to them, which is all just a bunch of horseshit. So anyway, I basically push back, and in my book, The Zyprexa Papers, that's kind of the last big case I did for Bill Bigley. It went on for over a month, I think 2 months, that it really ended up big. So, I really pressed them legally. They had never seen any kind of legal opposition to what they're doing until I started.
Yeah, that case with Bill Bigsley, I was like, I was so, it was so up and down because throughout the book, you would have a victory. They would rule. Yeah. No forced drugging in this case. And he, unless he consents. And then the next time he was admitted, they would file to force drug him, and then you would have to fight all over. Even though they just rolled before, you had to fight all over again to keep them from force drugging him. It was just, I was like, I don't understand. What's the point of rolling now if you're not going to enforce that same ruling later?
Well, it's funny you should mention it. So there's a legal procedure when you're on appeal, you what's called a stay pending appeal. And stay means to put the case on hold, or put not really the case, but put the order on hold until the, in this case, the Alaska Supreme Court got to rule. So there was this forced drugging order against Bill Bigley, and I got it stayed pending appeal, which takes usually about a year or more. And so they couldn't drug him, so they let him out. But he was just, he was, what do I want? How do I want to phrase it? I mean, he made people unhappy with the way he behaved. Let me put it that way. So he was doing all this stuff. I mean, he would yell at people. That's mainly what he did. He would yell at people. And I think he had every reason to yell at people. I mean, or every reason to be angry with what had happened to him. I mean, his life was just destroyed by psychiatry. And so the hospital wouldn't hang on to him, wouldn't file for involuntary commitment, psychiatric imprisonment, because they couldn't drug him because of his stay. And so he was causing all these problems in the community. And I had set up this system where he was given supports, you know, and basically someone, you know, kind of following him around and, you know, trying to calm down situations. And it really worked. And then that fell apart for some reason and all these problems. So, but anyway, he ended up causing these problems in the community. And the mental health court judge, who was also a minor crimes judge, or misdemeanor crimes judge, you know, really leaned on the hospital to commit him. So then they did, and they, you know, made this argument that the stay shouldn't apply. And the judge ended up going with them, and the Alaska Supreme Court let them do it, basically.
Maybe for people who haven't read any of these books or are not familiar with your work, what is it about? I mean, you know, the standard model of care. Yeah, if someone is maybe suicidal or causing problems out in the community or threatening to hurt somebody, the, you know, everyone's safety is involved. You might have them committed to a psychiatric hospital, and then they're giving these psychiatric drugs, and that helps them to be calm and collected. And then after a week or so, they're released, perhaps. What is it about that model that's not helpful, or that you are fighting against, or you have historically fought against?
Well, it's basically all of fraud. So, first off, the mental health system, with all this drugging, basically the drugs reduce for people with, you know, that have, you know, extreme kind of cases. That's the clinical term is psychosis. I'd like to say crazy, but some people don't like that. But reduces the potential recovery rate from 80% to 5%. The drugs reduce that if you put them and keep them on the drugs. Okay. And then if you get people off the drugs that have been on them for a while, the recovery rate goes up to 40%, which is, you know, 8 times better than 5, but half of 80. And so what that shows is how important it is to try and prevent, keep people from being put in, on these drugs in the first place. So, so that whole thing is just not true about the drugs helping people. They're very harmful and very counterproductive. In terms of harmful, they reduce the average lifespan by 20 to 25 years. And so that people aren't, the society isn't in an uproar about this, just demonstrates you know, how unvalued these people are. Okay, so you've got that. And then no more than 10% of the people who get psychiatrically incarcerated actually meet the commitment criteria.
Oh, wow.
So because you have to prove the person is a, you know, pretty serious danger to themselves or others by clear and convincing evidence. And the U.S. Supreme Court's held that, the clear and convincing. The argument was, well, you're locking people up like prisoners, you know, like criminals, so you should have to prove it by, beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Supreme Court said, well, they could never prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, so we'll just say clear and convincing, which it varies by state, but means highly probable. Yeah, the whole thing is kind of ridiculous. And so, but psychiatrists can't predict. Hmm. I mean, there have been all kinds of studies. They can't predict people who are going to be violent. And, you know, and that's shown all the time by all these, you know, mass shootings. Almost all of them have been in the mental health system. And in fact, it's probably true that almost all of them are the result of the psych drugs they were given, which is known to cause homicidal behavior and suicidal behavior. So, so I mean, that in a nutshell is, you know, is the problem, is that it's not, it's an insane system. And there are all these other approaches that have been shown to be helpful without all the harm. Bob Whitaker in Mad in America wrote about Soteria House, and their peer respites are very, you know, proven to be very good, and there are other things. The open dialogue approach that came out of Finland, and all these different housing first for people, instead of requiring people to take drugs in order to get housing or receive other, you know, other services. And we could get to 80%, and we're at 5%. So it's just ridiculous and horrendous. I mean, the amount of harm that's being done is incomprehensible.
The all of that, and in the Zyprexa papers, it's basically about you having access to files that who's in charge of Zyprexa? What's the
Eli Lilly. Yeah, Eli Lilly. So I had this case of Faith Myers versus Alaska Psychiatric Institute that won it to Alaska Supreme Court. And it involves Zyprexa, and I had an expert witness write a report called Olanzapine, Dangerous Drug, Dubious Efficacy. Olanzapine is a chemical name for Zyprexa, and posted it on the network, on the internet. And so there was this expert witness, David Eagleman, who was a great guy, a physician of conscience, and he called me out of the blue because he was involved in this case, this massive case over Zyprexa causing diabetes and other metabolic problems that Eli Lilly had hid from the doctors and lied about. When the doctor said, hey, this patient gained 100 pounds in 6 months on this drug, and that patient got diabetes, and they just denied that, even though they knew it was all true. And so he had access to documents that proved that, and was working with the reporter at the New York Times on an expose. And he called me up to subpoena him to get these documents and give them to the New York Times. And the secrecy order, it's called a protective order, that in that case, said that if he was subpoenaed from another case, that he had to give Eli Lilly notice and an opportunity to object before he gave me the documents. And I figured, and he wanted to know if I was interested in that, and of course I was. And I figured that, you know, they would immediately object, and I'd be arguing to the Alaska court why my client, which I didn't have at the time, would, you know, was entitled to this information, which is that, you know, they were trying to force Zyprexa on him. And so, you know, and the Supreme Court had ruled it has to be shown it's in his best interest. And so these documents, you know, would show that it's not in his best interest. But Eli Lilly was too slow, David Eagle, Dr. Eagleman got them to me, and I got them out to the New York Times, who actually already had that Eagleman had given to them, and out on the internet and to other people. I mean, I was burning DVDs and putting them in the mail and stuff. So it was quite a thing. And even though Eli Lilly was slow, you know, out of the blocks, I knew they'd be big and fast. So anyway, and they were, you know, pretty irritated. They threatened me with criminal contempt and to try and get me disbarred and all that kind of stuff. So about half the book is about that whole thing about the Zyprexa papers, and the other half is about my representation of Bill Bigley, who, like I said, his life was destroyed by psychiatry. Part of it was just finding a case. You can't just subpoena someone, you gotta have a case. And they, in Alaska in particular, these mental health psychiatric proceedings that are like really secret. And so I was handing out flyers at the hospital during these days that they had the hearings to try and get someone interested, to family members and stuff, and say, hey, I'm willing to represent your family member if he wants real representation. And then I don't know, I think I ended up doing like 10 trial court cases with Bill, and four trips to the Alaska Supreme Court.
The Zyprexa papers was very well written, and it was a lot of fun reading it. It was kind of like, I used to watch Matlock, like the TV series, and it was a lot like reading a very suspenseful court case. And it was fun. It was like you're in the courtroom, because throughout the book, you talk about being on trial and your defense and the you know, what Eli Lilly was coming up with. And it was just very exciting. And I thought it was cool because you talked about, like, at one point, I forget who it was, but you put them on hold, and your hold music was Bob Dylan, and you're listening to like AC/DC in the background while you were like downloading these files. It was funny.
Yeah, it was one of the judge from New York in this giant case, the federal judge. I decided, oops, maybe I better get a lawyer. And so anyway, yeah, it was quite the set of events. People had said before, oh, you should write a book. And I would say, why would I write a book? You know, I can just write something and put it on the internet. People find it. They don't have to pay anything. But when this happened, I knew it needed to be a book. And frankly, yeah, I think it should be a movie.
Well, yeah, that would be cool. But, you know, with like Eli Lilly, so they knew that these drugs were causing weight gain and diabetes and all these metabolic side effects, and they buried it. They hid it. They made it, you know, all of these files were confidential. And the argument was, well, our competitors can find out what we're in. But it was like, some of it was like newspaper articles and stuff that were confidential. These people at the top, these in charge of these drug companies, do you, in your opinion, think that they're overall, there's going to be some people who negatively react to these, but the benefit is that a lot of people are actually helped by them, and it's kind of like the greater greater good for the greatest number of people, and we can sacrifice a few. You know, what do you think? Or is it just all about money?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I try not to ascribe bad motives to people, but it's really hard here. And so, like, one of the things I talk about is the clinical trials that were conducted to get Zyprexa approved. And basically, they're fraudulent. So what they did is that, you know, you're supposed to have a placebo arm, right? Where, you know, just a control group. And for the control group, they had people that they abruptly withdrew from Haldol, which is, you know, like Thorazine, it's one of these neuroleptics, you know, marketed as, you know, antipsychotic, even though they don't have antipsychotic principles for properties for most people, but or effects. So it's known that if you abruptly withdraw people from Haldol or any of these neuroleptics, it causes people to become psychotic. And it's not an underlying mental illness. It's that these drugs block 70 to 90% of the dopamine in the frontal lobe, the basal ganglia, and the limbic system. And the brain has grown more receptors, dopamine receptors, to compensate for this blockage. And so when you withdraw it, then all of a sudden you have these problems. And there's never been shown to be any brain abnormality in people diagnosed, say, with schizophrenia before you introduce the drugs. So, but in any event, the point was that the control group was people that they deliberately induced psychosis to, increase psychosis. So it wasn't a legitimate control group. And even worse than that, well, most people experience, these psychotic symptoms when they're abruptly withdrawn. Some people actually do quite well when they're just taken off Haldol. And they threw those people out of the study. They called it placebo washout. So then that made Zyprexa look a lot better than this group that had psychosis induced in them. But even then, they had this this protocol or procedure called last observation carried forward. Is Zyprexa is so awful. It doesn't help people, and it has such terrible negative effects. And people aren't forced to be in these trials. And like droves of people just quit the trial. I think it was like 70% or so. And so what they did is they said, okay, well, we'll assume that it's a 12-week study, which is a problem in itself. We'll just assume that if this person dropped out at week two, that that's where they'd be in week 12 at the end of the year.
Oh, wow.
At the end of the trial. And it's like, well, what's the point of having a 12-week trial if you're only going to do it for two, you know, if you're going to do this? And so, you know, this, my point is to your question, is that these trials are just so fraudulently designed that it's hard to believe that, you know, there were pure motives in trying to get this drug approved. And then they illegally marketed it to little children and all that stuff. I mean, it's really horrific stuff.
Yeah, that's the part that's difficult to weed through is it a select number of people who they purposefully manipulate the study only to bring their drug on the market, even if it's not going to help people? Or do the lawyers that were fighting for it, do they believe that they're doing the right thing, or are they just out for the best interest of the company? Like, it's like, where's the gray area?
Well, I think the way to understand it is fundamentally the drugs are to help the people around the person. To, you know, this person is being disturbing. And so I used to think of them as a chemical straitjacket. When I found out about the, you know, dopamine blockage, it's really a chemical lobotomy. So it disables the people so they can't be so disturbing. And that's the benefit. So there was something else I was going to forget.
It's the same idea as yeah, these like Bill Bigley.
I remember disrupting. In the Myers case, the lawyer very much believed that he was doing the right thing, that really
helping
people by, but at the end of the Myers trial, he knew it wasn't true anymore, and he quit. He quit doing that. Yeah.
Tell me again about the Myers case.
So this was my first Alaska Supreme Court win, and that's the one where this Dr. Grace Jackson, I didn't mention her name before, wrote this report, olanzapine, dangerous drug, dubious efficacy. But she was someone that I represented, and they were trying to drug her against her will. And, you know, I represented her, and they got this order, and I got a stay from the Alaska Supreme Court on that. I presented all this evidence. And I mean, I don't know what you want to say about her, but and the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that you couldn't drug someone against their will unless you could show by clear and convincing evidence that it was in the person's best interest and there's no less intrusive alternative. And so that's never true. So I mentioned that only 10% of people that get psychiatrically incarcerated meet that criteria. They can never legitimately prove that the drugs, you know, are in the person's best interest and there's no less intrusive alternative, you know, because of all this harm and counterproductive nature. And then, you know, the legal proceedings are basically kangaroo courts.
So the lawyer in the Myers case, he was fighting on the side of she should have been forced to take the drugs.
Right.
And he thought he was doing the right thing.
Right. And then I presented all this evidence, and because he'd never heard of any of that. You know, the doctors just get up and lie. And they may think it's the truth because they've been, you know, indoctrinated into it. But it's not the truth. And the lawyers, the true role of the lawyers that get appointed in these cases is to check the box that the person had a lawyer. And oftentimes the lawyers, you know, think if my client wasn't crazy, they'd know this is good for them. And and so they don't, you know, try and, you know, really defend against being, you know, them being forcibly drugged. You know, and the judge feels the same way. And it's all because this information is never presented.
Yeah. I'm going to try to put a pin there for just a second. And I want to come back to that statement, if I can remember. Before that, you said, like, even if, you know, even if the criteria does hold, it's only for maybe 10%, but even that commitment. The commitment, you can't even prove that 10%.
I think you can prove the 10%. The 10% for commitment, I think you can prove the 10%. But for forced drugging, you can't legitimately prove it for anybody.
Okay. Is there ever a situation where you think forced drugging should be allowed?
No.
Okay. Is there an argument that people often might make about what if they're violent or what if they're trying to attack the, you know, workers or whatever?
So, I mean, the first thing is that you have to understand how But it, basically, this is violence perpetrated against the patients. And so that it's a quite natural reaction for them to get angry. And so in this, there are a couple of things. So there's this in Arizona, they had this hospital that there was a lot of seclusion and restraint, they call it, which is basically solitary confinement and tying people up. So this organization set up this program. It's called the Living Room Model. And when they and people are brought in by the police in handcuffs, they're not charged with a crime. And so, you know, there's reason for them to be upset. But they'd have someone who's called with peer, someone who has experienced the system before and gotten through it and gotten better. And they would sit down on the couch and be with the person. And they took the seclusion and restraint to virtually zero. So there are things that you can do. And like the mantra of the Soteria House was to, quote, be with people rather than to do to them. So that's the first thing, is the system really provokes people. It's violence perpetrated against the patients. And you know, and then when someone gets angry about it, that's written down as a psychiatric system, symptom rather than a normal reaction. You know, and in terms of predictions of violence, you know, there are people that are far more likely to commit violent crimes than people diagnosed with serious mental illness who don't have any appreciable greater level of violence than the general population. And whatever it is almost certainly due to the drugs. But like gang members, do we lock them up because they might commit, you know, violence in the future? No. So if someone commits a crime, fine. But just to say they're going to, you know, be violent in the future, no. And then in terms of harm to self, supposedly that's for suicide prevention. Well, it turns out that being locked up in a psych hospital like dramatically increases suicide. Like there's been a study that showed it's hundreds of times more likely someone will commit suicide after they've been psychiatrically imprisoned. So the idea that you lock someone up to protect them from themselves is just factually untrue. So, you know, so no. And I was involved in, well, I was kind of the lead author of this report on improving mental health outcomes with but Dr. Peter Gercher, who's one of the top medical researchers in the world, and Dr. David Cohen, who, you know, this very prominent professor of social work, and another couple of people, including Faith Myers, wrote, who became an incredible advocate. And we, you know, go through and document all this stuff, and we have links to the actual, most of the time, to the actual papers and books. So, no. We should not be forcing anybody psychiatrically. If they've committed a crime, fine. If you want to do something else because of, quote, their mental illness, don't force them.
What do you say to the like therapists or psychologists or psychiatrists who, let's say, have a patient who has made suicide attempts or has is saying that they're going to, and then the therapist is scared that if they don't involuntarily commit them and the patient does follow through with it and succeed, that they are going to be sued or held liable?
Well, so I mean, this idea of, I mean, I think a lot of our society, kind of stupid things are done, in order to avoid litigation. So I don't think anybody has actually been successfully sued in that regard. I mean, there was this Tarasov case, which, everybody got freaked out about. And so, but they weren't actually sued, or at least nobody was as successfully sued someone. So it's an overblown fear. I mean, you could cite all these statistics that, these studies that we you cite that say that, locking someone up actually dramatically increases suicide. So I think this fear-driven approach is just, it's just wrong. And, but you've got the psychiatrist, the supposed expert saying all this stuff. And so, it is the mode that people are in, for sure. But that's where peers come in. I mean, these peer respites, are really successful. There's a 5-minute video on YouTube called "How a FIA House Helped Me, which gives a pretty good idea about, what it's like in there. You can usually only stay 7 to 10 days, but it's a place where people can go and they're not forced. It's not locked. And they can, but they, their peers there to help people through them. And so, the point is the current, doing this is so counterproductive and harmful that, what should we do about that? Well, let's stop doing the harmful and counterproductive stuff.
What do you, think that most of this has been top down from pharmaceutical companies and advertising and them being in cahoots with psychiatry and psychiatrists believing it? And do you think it's been top down in that way? And in order to get out of that system, it's all about exposing these pharmaceutical companies and the drugs is not really effective. And like, do you think that what you and Robert Whitaker have done, do you think it's going to be enough to tip the scales, or what do you think needs to happen?
Well, it certainly hasn't been. I think things are getting worse, not better. With, the so-called care courts in California, there's all these moves around the country, including New York City, to make it easier to lock people up and drug them against their will. So, but I think, what happened was, I mean, the fundamental problem is that mental, quote, now the phrase that people, it seems to be not politically correct to say serious mental illness, which, so now it's mental health challenges. But in any event,
not really.
So it's not a medical issue. I mean, that's the problem. It's just not. It's a psychosocial problem. I mean, if it's a medical issue, I mean, some things are. Like people, Lyme disease, people have psychiatric symptoms. And then oftentimes they're put in the psychiatric system rather than their Lyme disease being treated. And there are other things like that. But that's, if it's a physical medical issue, it's not psychiatry. It's like neurology. And so fundamentally, psychiatry should not be in charge of mental health. Historically you had the psychiatrists, and, originally they were technically doctors, but, with psychoanalysis, that was not really medical treatment. It was talk therapy. But then what happened, like through the 40s and 50s, 60s, is you got all these other people doing talk therapy, including psychoanalysis, and the psychiatrists were losing their predominance, their authority over, mental health conditions. And so they made, so then they joined up with the pharmaceutical companies, and pretend that it's medical. And now all of a sudden they, you know, are the experts on this medical condition that isn't really a medical condition. And, you know, it shored up the place of psychiatry and, you know, makes massive amounts of money for the drug companies. So I think that's where what happened. And I think you know, how much do the psychiatrists believe it? Sadly, a lot. I mean, one of the things about getting to be an MD is usually you have to be a really compliant person to make it through, you know, and get that MD. So it's not, you know, so they're told all this stuff. They don't critically analyze it. I mean, a few psychiatrists do, like Peter Brecken, you know, who's been for decades has been raising all this stuff. And more recently, although not that recently, I mentioned Dr. Grace Jackson. She was in the Navy and she's a psychiatrist and treating her patients. And she discovered, she just looked and said, I'm not helping my patients. What's going on? And so then she found out the truth about all this. And so there's some that do, but almost all don't.
What do you see tipping the scales? What do you see getting away from the medical model of treating this?
So I've put forth this kind of strategic approach to changing things. And the most important thing is changing the public attitudes so that they understand what's going on. The second most important thing is having other options. And those reinforce each other. I call it the transformation triangle. So those reinforce each other. So to the extent that the public understands that these other approaches work better without the harm, then there'll be more support for these other approaches. And to the extent these other approaches can prove that they work better without the harm, that will, you know, help change public attitudes. And so that's two points on the triangle. The third point is honoring people's legal rights. And so, for example, people have the right to a less restrictive alternative with respect to psychiatric incarceration and a less intrusive, the least intrusive alternative for both with respect to forced drugging. And that's a restriction on the government's power. Although the last Supreme Court got that wrong in the case. So in other words, if you had the lawyers who were really fighting to keep their clients from being locked up and drugged or electroshocked against their will, then, and, you know, like I said, only 10% of the people can legitimately be locked up and no one can be drugged or forced against their will. So, that, and if you have that, that will put pressure on to have other options to become available. But even though the judge should rule, I'm not going to lock this person up because of some theoretical alternative that I can't actually send this person to. So I'm not going to do that. So to the extent there actually are those options available, then people's rights to them will be more likely to be honored. And then the third side between public opinion and honoring legal rights is a little bit harder to see, but one direction is it. To the extent that the public understands that these interventions, forced interventions, are harmful and counterproductive, it makes it more likely that people's rights to them will be honored. Going the other way is a little bit harder to see how the legal cases can change public opinion. But, well, it's interesting. I would say that segregation was an example of that, that before Brown versus Board of Education 1954 ruling, legal segregation by law was unconstitutional. A wide swath of the country felt that it was okay because the Supreme Court said it had. And after Brown versus Board of Education, you could hardly find anybody who would say that segregation was okay. More recently, I think that's been drawn into question a little bit. But that's a way that the legal cases can help change public opinion. So I think those are the three most important things: public attitudes, alternatives, and I call it strategic litigation, with public education by far being the most important.
That sounds like in a lot of ways, the model that we have now was a top-down approach, and there's advertisements every day on TV for psychiatric drugs that, ask your doctor about this. But maybe countering it is going to be a more of a bottom-up approach. And it's going to be people at the bottom, because I don't think there's even trying to get the information out there to the public, I don't think that's going to be a top-down approach,
No, of course not.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. And like the peer, it's all so hard because of all the money on the other side. But so like the peer support movement, is really important, the peer respite. But that whole idea has been co-opted and corrupted by the system. And so now you've got, so-called peers whose job is to ensure, medication compliance. And, that's just anathema, completely contrary to the whole principle of peer support. It's a struggle. And I think actually the response to COVID and, this pushing of these lying about the vaccines may end up have some spillover effect, because I think a lot more people have gotten skeptical about what the drug companies and the government says about drugs.
Can you tell us a little bit about, I Googled you, and from November of 2024, it looks like in Minnesota, there's someone who's undergoing forced electroshock. Can you tell us a little bit about your work with electroshock, and how often does forcing that happen? Yeah.
So it happens a lot in some states, and Minnesota is particularly bad. California is bad. Texas is bad. I think Virginia is bad, and New York is bad, and maybe other states. Minnesota may be the worst. So I also work with this organization called Mind Freedom International, mindfreedom.org. And they have this program called the Mind Freedom Shield Alert. And people who are can sign up for the SHIELD program, and then if they're subjected to forced psychiatry, they can ask for an alert to go out. It's a public alert, and we mobilize people to complain to those that are doing it and otherwise make a big ruckus to try and get them to stop. And so David Russell in Minnesota he was informed they were going to try and force the electroshock on him, and he contacted Mind Freedom. We did that, and ultimately we were successful in stopping it, but only after he got 17 shocks against his will. He's just in such a box I mean, they got this guardianship on him to take away all his rights, because he refused to sign up for medical assistance to pay for things he didn't want. So then they said, "Oh, well, we're doing all this shit to him, but we need to get paid to do all this shit he doesn't want." So then they took away his right to not sign up for that. And so, I mean, so that's kind of his big legal problem right now. And he's got this lawyer who literally is working for the other side. And we got a different lawyer in his commitment case. And that worked, but I don't think we're going to be able to keep him. I think it's really mind freedom that got the electric shock stopped, and then they wanted to add Clozaril to the drugs they could force on him. But it was so screwed up legally that the lawyer, it was like shooting ducks of to get that stopped. But the lawyer that had been appointed to him, I don't think he would have even objected. And when David says, "My lawyer isn't doing anything for me," then that's, considered part of his delusional structure, that he's delusional about that. So once you get in that situation, anything you do is written down as a symptom. So like if they do something that legitimately makes you angry, then that's marked down as being, he's labile, right? Then if you decide that, "Well, I'm just not going to react to all these provocations," well, then you have a flat affect, right? And then if you just kind of chuckle to yourself at the absurdity of all this stuff, then you're responding to internal stimuli. So I think of it like Alice in Wonderland once you get in that situation.
And if you say, no, they're trying to poison me, then that's part of your delusion.
Correct.
Do you think there is anything to say for if someone is in a bad enough state to where they're not competent to make their own choices?
No. So, I mean, no, basically no. I mean, it's actually a violation of international law. Under the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, United Nations Convention, you can't base any unwanted interventions on someone's lack of capacity, which is what competence is. So no, people can be supported in their decision making. So it's hard because there are, situations that are very difficult. But it's not the way to go.
You just mentioned, so I was looking into advanced directives, and it seems to me that even if you, because the whole argument is that they're not competent to reject psychiatric treatment or drugs. So even if you, in my competent state, I have capacity to make this decision now. So I write out an advanced directive that if I'm ever, like a psychiatric one, if I'm ever psychiatrically hospitalized, I don't want to take psychiatric medication. That can still be overridden by psychiatrists who deem it's in your best interest.
Well, it varies by state. And I mean, basically, the legal principle is everybody has the absolute right to decide what drugs to take, unless you lack capacity to make that decision, right? And so you're right. So if you sign an exact advance directive when you're competent, then that shouldn't be overridden. One of the things that they do is they say, well, you weren't competent when they signed it. And so some forms, and this is all state by state, some forms have, you know, a witness or something that attests to the person's competence at the time, and that's good. And I recommend that people have someone do that, hopefully with the highest ranking letters after their name. In other words, like an MD is the highest rank, right? A PhD is maybe the second, and then a PsyD, or, you know, even, but at least someone, even if the form doesn't say that. But basically, the hospitals don't know anything but to drug some. So, you know, it's like, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so, and I think a really apt analogy here with your brain being the nail. And so they don't, you know, they just, so they find ways not to follow them, which is usually they just ignore them. And there's no one that really will try and enforce it. So the most states, I think most states, if you're determined to lack capacity or be incompetent, you can appoint someone to be your substitute decision maker. And that is really important that you get someone that will really stand up for you in that. I mean, I shouldn't say this because I'm not really willing to do it, but I've been named as a substitute decision maker in certain cases. And I think it's better than being the lawyer, because you have the right to decide. Whereas a lawyer, all you have, you just get to try and persuade the judge. So, but I had a situation where I was, and they just ignored me. And it was just, I still have nightmares about what happened to this person.
A lot of this is based on all of the negative side effects of the psychiatric drug. So let's say there was a psychiatric drug that could calm someone, that could abate their symptoms for temporarily, and that didn't lead to any negative side effects. Would it still be argued against administering those to people?
Well, so A, that doesn't exist, and probably unlikely to exist. But I think it kind of brings up something for me I want to say, is I know people that find them helpful, including the neuroleptics. And, you know, I think they should have access to them, although there's an argument that maybe not neuroleptics. But anyway, I think if they find them helpful, they want them, they should have access to them. A lot of people just use them periodically, when they start to have problems, that they'll use it to calm themselves down. That's fine. Not children. Children should never be given these drugs. Why should you force someone? I mean, one of the things is that the way I look at it is it's so easy to lock people up and drug them against their will. I consider it like the path of least resistance. So the doctors, they don't even bother to talk with their patient and try and come to something. I mean, Lauren Mosher, who I mentioned before, he testified in the Myers case. He did the Soteria House study, and he was the chief of schizophrenia research at the National Institute of Mental Health at the time of Soteria. Anyway, he said that, if someone was about to do grievous harm to someone, I would, you know, try and prevent that, but basically call the police, because the therapeutic relationship is the most important thing. And, you know, you can't have a good relationship if you're forcing someone. But the other thing, but he said, I've never had to do that, because I've always, you know, spent the time to work with my patient where we can come up with a plan that we can both agree to. So So he never had to do it. And I asked him, do you have much experience? I knew the answer, of course. You're always supposed to know the answer. Do you have much experience with, unmedicated people on that are psychotic? And he says, oh my Lord, I've probably had more experience with unmedicated psychotics than anyone alive today. And I find them among my most interesting patients. So that's kind of the attitude that you have to have. And basically, usually people are in this state are terrified. And the two most important things are sleep and to try and make them feel safe. And the hospitals are terrible on both things. I mean, I recently heard about, I think it's in Ohio, where the hospitals are coming in every 15 minutes at night and, scanning their bracelets. So they're waking people up every 15 minutes. And of course, hospitals tend to be noisy. And so the sleep part is terrible in hospitals. And so is the safety part, because there's all this, that people feel unsafe and they kind of are unsafe. I mean, basically, for psychiatry, there's violence perpetrated against these patients. So I kind of forget where this started
Oh
from.
no, yeah.
But,
So part of it is that these people are scared, they're terrified, and we're bringing them in to an environment that feels unsafe. And then when they act out, we say, look, we need to be able to administer these tranquilizers because they're acting out. But part of the argument is also that the therapists and the nurses and the doctors shouldn't be doing that. It should be security or the police who try to restrain the patient because the therapeutic relationship is important.
well,
But
so it's interesting. And one of the bigwig cases, I mean, so there is in Alaska, there's kind of forced drugging, to help people. And then there's forced drugging because the person is so out of control at the minute that it's an emergency. And so the forced drugging, because it's supposedly in the person's best interest is. The legal justification is called the Perrin's Patriae Doctrine, which is basically that this person is incompetent and you have to be the parent of that person and make decisions for them. But the emergency drugging is under the police power, it's like safety. Okay. In Alaska, there's very strict procedures for emergency drugging, which they don't follow. And I asked this psychiatrist that I testified in the case. I said, well, what about if this person was really out of control and you had to do something, and you can go and ask him and tell him, look at you're doing this stuff and we can't have it. So we only have two choices. I mean, three really. You can calm down, but you can. We can put you in the quiet room in the seclusion, or maybe tie you up, restrain, or we can give you a shot of Haldol to calm you down. Which would you prefer? And I said, I think. Or I guess it had to be a question. Do you think that might even calm the person down? And he said, yes, just to be given that choice. And they might choose to go in the room. I mean, in that video I mentioned, how Aphia House helped me, I mean, the person talks about how sometimes they just need to be kind of, so she said she found the hospital help, being locked up helpful. And then the response was, well, we have locks on the door, but they're on the outside. And if you want to, if you want to stay in your room, fine. And so It's just all this force is just, it's not, I mean, the kind of the mantra is, if it's not voluntary, it's not treatment. And I think that's very true.
I forget where I read this. I don't, it might have been in Mad in America, and it was something along the lines of people who usually fight for more relaxed involuntary commitment laws are parents and psychiatrists, and people who fight against them are patients. And I forget the other one, but it's not really the patients who are fighting for, like, yeah, that involuntary commitment was good for me, and we need more of that.
There are a tiny minority, or you know, maybe like 1/100 of 1% that say that it was helpful to them. And there's this law professor, Ellen Sachs, who's a psychiatric survivor, who didn't come out until she got tenure, by the way. But anyway, she wrote this book called, I forget. It's ELYNSAKS. But before that book, she wrote a book about called Refusing Care, I think. And her idea was that the government should be allowed one free shot, that they should be allowed to force it on someone one time to see if they found it helpful. I don't agree with that, but I think interesting idea. Again, I know, I mean, why can't you just sit down with someone and, you know, talk with them? I mean, the idea is that what they're saying, they're so crazy that, you know, that what they're saying is just the product of misfiring neurons rather than a result of, and a reaction to things that have gone on in their lives.
It reminds me again of the, it's more of a bottom-up approach of top-down is a cookie-cutter approach for everybody, and we don't really know how to do this, so we're going to have these big facilities and they're going to just kind of drug everyone and we'll see how it goes. Bottom-up, it's more like the people see the problem, community kind of come together, they start these small houses like the Sotira Project, or Lauren Mosher started the two houses. It just seems more like a, yeah, the more I talk with you about this, it seems more and more apparent that this is going to be almost what's the word? Yeah, it doesn't seem like a big all-encompassing approach is going to fix it. It's going to be like, what's the word, man? You know what
Well,
I'm trying to say?
it's individualized, but I mean, there was a psychiatrist, Nat Lehrman, and he was actually ran a psych hospital, and then he ended up in it. And he found, and I had there's some things he wrote. I mean, he died a few years ago, and he was, you know, I mean, he was quite elderly at the time, but when he died, but so this was a long time ago. And he found that what really helped him was playing the violin. So it's just different for people. And one of the things that's so corrosive, again, is this idea that what nothing some, you know, someone thinks is of any value because it's misfiring neurons. And one of the fallouts for that is that people aren't asked what they think will be helpful. You know, I mean, and it's such an obvious thing. What do you think will be helpful? Let's try it. You know, and then, I mean, like in the one of the famous stories from Soteria House is this person was convinced that a spaceship was going to come on Thursday to the park and pick him up. And the normal reaction was, oh, would be to be, oh, that's delusional. Don't be ridiculous. But the soteria approach was, okay, let's go. And they went to the park and waited, and the spaceship didn't come. And it's like, okay, well, now what do you want to do? And another example was this person who thought they were poisoning him with the food. And so they said, okay, well, let's go to McDonald's. And so you just don't tell people, oh, they're being delusional. There are reasons why people think what they do. And so you just have to establish a relationship with them and then work through things. And that works for about 80%. We haven't figured out the other 20%, but 80% is way better than 5%.
Well, maybe after they make a movie about the Zyprexa papers, we can get back together and talk about your reaction to the movie.
You bet.
Yeah. I
You
really
tell the
enjoyed
good
having you on.
producers, turn them on to me.
Okay, I will. Unfortunately, I don't know any, but I'll keep my ear out. I really appreciate having you on today. Is last thing, is there anything that you feel like you haven't been able to say during this interview, or especially for people who are maybe new to this information or coming on to this area of research that you would like to point them to or to address?
Well, I mentioned the report on improving mental health outcomes. And so psychrights.org, psychrights.org, we have a lot of information. And then there's this PANE Advisory Council Empowerment Project I'm involved in, and there's a link to it. And it turns out that the federal government pays an army of lawyers to, quote, enforce the rights of individuals with mental illness, even though that's not the correct term anymore. But that's the act. It's called the PANE Act. And there are these advisory councils that are supposed to jointly determine with these protection advocacy agencies what their priorities are. And that whole process, the whole purpose of the act has been subverted. And so we're really trying to get the advisory councils empowered to make enforcing people's rights not to be psychiatrically imprisoned and drugged or electroshocked against their will a priority. And there's an opportunity to kind of participate in that. So there's a link to that on the psychrights.org website with information about that.
Okay. Yeah, I'll link all of these things we've talked about today. I'll link them in the description box.
Super.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you, sir. I appreciate all of your work, and I appreciate you making the time to come on and take a break from the Maui landscape to talk to me.
You bet, my pleasure.